following is brought to you by Canyon Ridge Church at Tacoma. For additional podcasts or information on service times and upcoming events, please visit us online at www.explorecrc.com.
So I'd like to start today by asking you to think a little bit. And I will give apologies in advance for any of those of you who are not planning on doing that this weekend. But I want to ask you this. Who do you trust enough to speak deeply into your life? Who do you trust enough that they could tell you the truth about what you absolutely need to change? They could tell you that, and you would still like them. Who do you trust enough that when they do share some hard truth with you, you will actually change your life for the better after they do? Now, hopefully you have someone in mind. Hopefully you've got, you know, a happy image in your head of maybe just a few select people, right? And those people, they mean a lot to us. We value those people. They are precious. I mean, if they were to walk out of our lives right now, we couldn't just go find another person and go, psh, that's fine, I'll put somebody else in that place. It might take years to fill that void. Or we might never. I mean, my guess is that your number, like mine, is very small. And maybe even some of us would say, we're not sure we have anyone who fits that description. So hopefully you have someone. If you've got someone, if you've got some few people in mind, keep those in mind. If you don't, pick the person closest to that. And let me keep asking you some questions about that. Now, we say we love them, right? We say at least that we really trust these people. We say that they have this place of privilege, that when they speak to us, they could change the course of our lives. We say that, but keep thinking with me, is that even true? Think of your favorite hobby. I mean, the thing that you would do when you get a pick, right? Maybe it's just watching the Seahawks. Maybe it's going boating. Maybe it's playing video games. Maybe it's reading a book. I don't know, but what's the one thing that you do as much as you can of right now? Not like, you know, hey, if I had $1 million, here's what I would do. No, like right now, when you get spare time in your life, what's the thing that you would go to when you get a pick? Now, what would happen if your special trusted advisor person came to you and told you nothing more than this? They just came up and said, hey, your favorite hobby is taking up too much of your life. Your faith, your family, and your friends are going to suffer until you give up your hobby completely. Just thought you should know. And they're done. What would happen? Seriously. I mean, half of you are probably already done with this little thought experiment. You're like, that would never happen. So I'm not even going to answer the question. Not even in my own mind am I going to answer the question. But the other half of you, seriously, if your trusted advisor came up to you and point blank to your face said those words, you've got to give up the Seahawks, or you've got to quit doing CrossFit. You've got to stop going hiking in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. Whatever your favorite thing is, would you even listen to them? Probably not. Probably not, because it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Probably not because that is not what you want to hear. Probably not because, you know, maybe those people are amazing, but they're just overstepping their bounds a little bit this time. Probably not because, and this one's important, even if something deep down inside of you knows that they're right, the change would be too painful to go through. So you're just not going to do it anyway. And that's how it would be with a trusted friend or family member who we said could speak into the deepest part of our lives. Now, maybe they could, you know, in some way, maybe they could convince us to change, but we certainly wouldn't do it just because they came up and said something to us, right? We would ask for proof. Show me how this hobby is so destructive. Show me whose lives are getting ruined. Show me where all of my priorities are just going down the toilet. We'd ask for alternatives. Prove to me that I have to give it up. Why can't I just scale it back? Why can't I just schedule things better or keep my hobby the way it is and increase, you know, my involvement with the other things that are supposed to be important in my life? In short, we wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be enough for us to just be convinced that they were offering us some good advice. We would have to be convinced that this was like the only possible good choice that we could make. Really convince me. And then we'd sleep on it, right? And we'd delay. And we'd hope it just kind of went away. And our amazing trusted advisor person who's looking out for us would just keep reminding us day after day after day, you're ruining your life, you're ruining your life, still ruining your life. And then after all of that, maybe we would change for a week. And we might go back, right? We might go back and forth dozens of times before that change would become permanent in our lives, if it ever does. So let me ask you again. Do you really have anyone you trust enough that when they do share some hard truth with you, you will actually change your life as a result? I mean, sure, I used a little bit of a silly example, but this is a real issue. It's a real issue. Who can speak to you about your character? Who can speak to you about your sin? Those of you that have it, of course, you know. Who can speak to you about your priorities? Who can tell you when you're wrong? Who can tell you when you really are the problem, when you need to change? Who can tell you who you need to become? Who can tell you who you are? I ask because Jesus doesn't. Jesus doesn't in the passage of Scripture that we're going to focus on today. He doesn't ask. He just launches in and boldly starts telling us who we are. And I want us to approach this message from just this crazy perspective. We're not here today to get smarter. That's not our goal. We're not here today to get some great advice. We're not here to go, yep, heard that before. Ooh, that's interesting. Maybe that's my little nugget to take home with me today. No. We are here to be changed. We are here to be changed. Will you listen today, not for what's new, not for what's interesting or what might work, what might, you know, go in my tool bag and see if I use that a little bit later. Will you listen today for what God wants to change in you starting today? Our passage today is from Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. And let me set the stage for you. We've been in this teaching series called Follow. It's built on the idea that out of all history, there is one person who didn't fall into the same failures that everyone else has. There is one person whose understanding of heaven and earth and of how those things are supposed to fit together was flawless. There is one person who actually lived every day of his life focused only on what was the most important. One and only one. And fortunately for us, he was a teacher too. I mean, Jesus didn't have to be a teacher, right? It's not the only profession to have. But fortunately for us, he was a teacher too. So this series is about taking an up-close look at the life and the teachings of Jesus Christ as written in the Gospel of Matthew, so we might learn how to follow in his footsteps. The setting today is on a mountainside. Jesus had been teaching and healing people in many cities around the region, and the Bible tells us he was starting to gain a following. Some he had personally selected and gone to them and called them out and said, you need to follow me. That's probably the right choice for your life. Others, though, also decided to follow him, to become disciples. or they were just fascinated by his teaching and his works. And so the Bible tells us that large crowds from multiple regions began following him around as he would travel and he would teach. I mean, I don't know what all these people did with their jobs or their families or, you know, all the things they're supposed to be responsible for, but they just, you know, when Jesus finished one sermon, they just didn't want to leave. You know, he was a better teacher than I was, apparently. They just followed him around waiting for the next one. Or likely for some, it wasn't the sermons, it was the miracles. And I'm guessing that just no matter how many times you've seen Jesus do something impossible, it just never gets old. The introduction to the Sermon on the Mount tells us that on this particular day, Jesus saw the crowds gathering, so he went up on a mountainside or a hillside, and it doesn't say that the crowds followed him. It says he went up on the hillside and his disciples followed him, and he taught them. We don't know how many were there. I mean, it doesn't tell us, but it was probably a lot more than just the 12 that we normally think about. There were multiple crowds. Out of them, those who could be called disciples followed Jesus up on this hillside and listened to him teach. They weren't just waiting around for the next miracle show. They wanted to hear what he had to say. And maybe this simple act of following them to the place where he would teach and they would listen, maybe that simple act alone qualified them to be called disciples. There had to have been a wide range of people there. Some who had quit their jobs and were following Jesus everywhere. Some who were maybe there in their first steps of exploring faith in Jesus. And for those who came to hear the Messiah, the Savior of the world, give a teaching straight from God, Jesus didn't disappoint. He delivers a world-class opener, a series of teachings today we know as the Beatitudes. He starts with 9 blessings, but they're original, and they're fresh, and they're challenging. Oh, and they connect really well with his audience. You know, instead of the blessings that they've seen all around to the rich and the powerful, the Roman Empire, those guys seemed pretty blessed. He tells of blessings for the poor in spirit, those who mourn, those who long for something better spiritually, those who are persecuted because of their faith. 9 blessings. That's a good way to start your teaching. That's a good way to get people interested. But Jesus does something really interesting with those 9 blessings that his audience probably didn't even recognize. He starts by just teaching stuff that's true, blessings that are true, and letting people catch it if they want to. Blessed are the meek. Maybe I'm blessed. I can be meek sometimes. Right? Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are those who are persecuted for their faith. Hey, everyone, I'm just telling you the truth about some people who are blessed. Blessed are those people, of course, as he's going through the list, though. People are getting a little bit more interested. And this audience of Jewish people under Roman oppression, probably every audience member saw themselves in at least one of these blessings. They knew, or at least they suspected, that Jesus was speaking directly to them. Wasn't he? And then on blessing 9, the last of them, Jesus makes a subtle shift and he comes out with it. Blessed are them. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are those who, and then blessing 9, blessed are you. When people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Ah, he said it. On the last and final blessing, he seals the deal. Everyone wanted to hear it. Everyone thought that they were hearing it. Jesus had spoken 8 blessings without quite saying it. And now on the last one, Jesus uses that word, you, for the first time in the Sermon on the Mount. And it's the longest blessing of the 9, and he mentions the word you or your 6 times in it. They weren't quite sure, But he made it clear he was talking straight to them. And it's like the tagline for THX Sound. The audience is listening. They're listening. They're hearing something good. They know Jesus is talking straight to them, and they might even be just a little bit open to whatever would come next. And well, let's hope so, because the very next thing Jesus does is he tells them who and what they are. Let's read starting at verse 13. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives life to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Bold move, Jesus. Bold move. Sure, start with the blessings. Tell them the good stuff. Rope them in. Get their attention. And then give them a new identity? I mean, it's almost like in his opening, he's just handing out free food, you know? Like, hey, we want to get people listening, right? Come on in. We got free grub. And then after that, he changes the focus and he's handing out uniforms. He's got a job assignment for these people, an identity for them. He tells his audience, by the way, the world is depending on you. But I just came to hear about God's laws and God's Messiah. You are the salt of the earth. Tell me more about those blessings. You are the light of the world. Explain God's commandments to me. Whatever you do, do not lose your saltiness. Reassure me that God has a plan for his people. That's why I'm here. You are the light of the world. His plan is for you to shine in the darkness. And this is a shift that never gets undone for the rest of Jesus' sermon. From now on, the focus is on you, who you are, what your role is, and what God requires of you. It's strap-in time because Jesus begins this focus here, but he never lets it up. So let's look briefly this morning at what Jesus is talking about when he calls us salt, when he calls us light. I mean, if you've been in church long enough, you probably heard a message or two or a dozen or so on this passage. And especially when it comes to being the salt of the earth, you might have even heard conflicting messages on it, right? What the heck does that mean? Because honestly, Jesus doesn't even explain it in great detail here. Don't you love that? Hey, everybody, let's get this straight up front. Let's do it. You are salt. Don't you ever not be salty or you'll be useless. Moving on. What? I mean, I think I just summarized the words that Jesus said in his sermon there. Is everyone clear on that one then? I mean, can we just go on to the light of the world stuff now? I mean, no, we're not clear. And honestly, this is one of those that I hope Jesus explains to me a little bit more when I get to heaven someday. I'm going to be like, all right, what was the deal with the salt thing? Because preachers and Bible scholars have looked at a lot of different angles on this one. I'll tell you they have. Salt, okay. The primary thing that salt was used for in the ancient world was a preservative. It was a preservative for meats and things. So it wouldn't spoil as quickly. So maybe Jesus is saying that his disciples are in some way protecting and preserving the world. But another common thing that salt was used for, same as it is today, was in seasoning. And that one actually makes really good sense here because Jesus specifically says that if salt loses its saltiness or its flavor, you could be translated, or the Greek word in here actually means if the salt becomes dull, so it's kind of if it becomes tasteless, then it's useless. So I guess we are the seasoning of the world. I think we figured that one out. What does that mean? Right? Perhaps it refers to the ways that we can bring real truth and real life into a world that only has counterfeits as long as it ignores God. So, okay, a preservative or a seasoning, those are okay choices. But then others will look in the Bible and they'll say, you know, there's some more biblical, there's some more spiritual answers to this than that. If you do a word study on salt in the Bible, you'll find some interesting things. You'll find that salt was used as a purifying substance in the Bible. Ooh, oh, that's good. Oh, yeah. We're here to be pure. We're here to bring purity to the world. I like that. Okay? Or if you look throughout the Old Testament, you'll find that God was very interested in salt as a symbol of his covenant. It was actually required to be added to certain offerings that were given in the temple. And there's more than one place in the Bible when God himself speaks to his people and says, I am making a covenant of salt with you. He still doesn't explain what that means there, but he says it. And so perhaps being salt is being a symbol of the covenants that God is making with his people. It's a symbol that God is faithful, that God has provided his grace and his mercy for his people, and he is faithful to his covenant, and we are that reminder in the world day in and day out. And I'm sure there are even more suggestions than these. But what do we do here? I mean, Jesus has given us this identity, and we don't even know what he meant. How can we possibly live it out? And this is one of those cases. See, I think we do this in a lot of places, but this is one of those cases where if we don't look out, we can get so frustrated with what we don't know that we don't focus on what we do know. I honestly don't know if Jesus meant one of those four things, two of them, three of them, all four of them, you know, combination, thinking about them all. I don't know. But here's what we can see, and here's what we can know about this. First off, we know this. The world needs you. The world needs you. Whether it's because you are preserving it or seasoning it or bringing it purity or inviting it into covenant with God, the point here is the world desperately needs you. Do you ever think about that? Now, there's definitely a right way and a wrong way to think about that, okay? This isn't meant to puff us up. Of course the world needs me. Sun barely comes up in the morning without my permission. That's not what I'm talking about, okay? That's not what Jesus means here either. But as a follower of Christ, you are connected to the source of life. The only one who can truly save, the ultimate source of truth, the God who holds not just time but eternity in his hands. And as followers of Christ, it's not that we just know this information. I mean, the information's out there. It's on the internet, I guarantee you. But the internet isn't saving anybody, folks. It's not just that this information is inside of us, but it's that God uses us. He uses us to reveal this reality to our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, and the people he brings across our path. God has chosen us to reveal him to this world. Think about it. His mission is in our hands. His mission is in our hands. He has a pretty bold mission. He wants to save every single person on this planet who's willing. He wants to let every single person on this planet know who he is and what he has done for them. He wants every single person on this planet to experience his personal love and care and compassion for them. His joy that he will give them. The forgiveness and the freedom that he offers to them. And for some amazing reason, God has decided to entrust us. Us, his people, his disciples, those who would follow him. For some amazing reason, he's entrusted us to be his representatives to every lost soul on the planet. And we don't just have his message. Our lives are his handiwork. Ephesians 2:10 in the New Living Translation says, we are God's masterpiece. There's something about us. When God's work is full in us, we show the world who God is. Our lives point to the Creator and to the Savior, to the Lord and the Redeemer. Do you realize that the world needs you? Do you realize it? You are the salt of the earth. That means, one, that the world needs you, and two, that the world needs you to be different. The world doesn't just need you. The world needs you to be different. This is really the only commentary Jesus provides on the whole salt of the earth thing. If you lose your saltiness, if you become dull, you might as well be thrown out into the streets and walked on. Think about it. Salt without saltiness, that's just sand, right? If it had no flavor, you wouldn't pour it on your food. I mean, nobody goes to the movies, pays their $10 for their popcorn, and goes, hey, do you have any sand that I can put on this? You know, nobody does that. If salt isn't going to be what it's supposed to be, it should be thrown out and trampled on. It's useless. So it's a message of congratulations, disciples. The world needs you, right? However, it needs you because you are different. Throughout the Old Testament, this is the teaching that Jesus studied all throughout his growing up. He knew the Old Testament backwards and forwards. And throughout the whole Old Testament, God has been calling his people to be different from the rest of the world. There are many verses we could point to, but one command in particular sums it up. Leviticus 19:2 is a place where God is instructing Moses, the leader of the nation of Israel. This is them first really being formed as a nation, and God saying, I want you to know this right from the beginning, folks. So God tells Moses, speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. Now, holy, that's a fancy church word right there. But it means completely set apart. Completely set apart. Ever since God had a people, he was calling them to be set apart the way he is set apart. The world's got plenty of sand. People walk on it every day. But God says, I'm calling you to be someone, something different. If you're just going to be like the rest of the world, you'll face judgment just like the rest of the world will. What they need, what you need, is to be connected with what's holy. Later on in the Sermon on the Mount, you'll know that Jesus has this passage in mind because he will speak directly to this issue, and he issues this command later on in the same message. Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. And you know his audience is like, hey, I've heard that somewhere before. God said this before, and he's saying it again. You are the salt of the earth, and that means that the world needs you. And that means that the world needs you to be different. But you're also the light of the world. You're like a city or a town on a hill that is meant to be seen. Now, the good news here, folks, is with light, there's not nearly the salt controversy, you know? You know, the salt controversy we're all talking about all the time. That doesn't exist with light because Jesus actually talked a lot about light and darkness in his ministry. So we have a lot more to compare this teaching to. And in his teaching, it's fairly consistent that light refers to truth. Light refers to guidance that leads to life. Jesus himself taught something a little different than what we're looking at here. He taught that he is the light of the world. Jesus himself said, I am the light of the world. I am the truth. I am the one who can guide people to life. He is clearly what every single person walking in the darkness needs. However, and this is shocking, but this is a title that he passes on. In John 9:5, Jesus makes a very interesting comment. He says, while I am in the world, I am the light of the world. He qualifies it. And as we have already seen in the Sermon on the Mount, early on, Jesus started letting his disciples know this is a title they needed to take on. Now you are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And these roles are taught together because they are complementary. Like being salt of the earth, being the light of the world says, first of all, that the world needs you. Hey, if you're tracking along, This one's not hard to learn. The world does not know the truth. The world is not naturally being guided the right way. The world does not know the truth about humanity's purpose. They don't know the truth about what God has done for us. The truth about right and wrong. The truth about good and evil. They don't know it, and we didn't know it before Christ revealed it to us. The world is lost. The world is in darkness. The world needs light. And just like we saw previously, the world needs you to be different. The same point is here. Jesus doesn't really mention it in this place here. There are other places that kind of refer to it, but it can be implied. If your light looks a lot like darkness, if it's about to go out, if it only reaches about a foot in front of your face, it's doing no good to anyone far away that needs to be guided. The world needs you to be different if you're light as well. Yes, the world needs you. Yes, the world needs you to be different. But there is a third teaching here that Jesus stresses as well, particularly when he talks about being light of the world, and it's this. You need to show the world good deeds that represent God well. It's kind of a long thing. I don't think everyone's going to memorize it, so maybe you should write it down. But you need to show the world good deeds that represent God well. Once again, we have a subtle shift in Jesus' teaching. I mean, he's already gotten pretty darn personal, right? He's assigned new identities to people, okay? So he's in their faces. He's told them who they must be. He gives the only direct command of the passage, though. To this point, he's been talking about the identity. He's assigned it to them, and he said, you know, if you were light, you know, you would want to shine. You wouldn't want to hide that. Right? He teaches it kind of like that, but then there really is only one direct command where he says, not just are you light, but here's what you must do. And that command is this: let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. That's the way it looks in most translations. I looked this up in several translations, but I read some commentary on it saying that this could possibly be translated a little bit better in a more active voice. Because in the Greek, if you look in the Greek original manuscripts on this, there's not a verb written there for let or allow or, you know, don't stop it from happening, right? Because when we see that phrase, let your light shine, it sounds pretty passive. But there's no Greek word in there for allow your light to shine or let your light shine. So it might be better translated this way. One command: shine your light. Shine your light before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Don't just let it happen. Shine your light into the darkness. It's not enough just to accept the job title and start using it. Yes, I am the light of the world. I'm part of it anyway. I'm a disciple of Jesus, right? That's not enough. It's not enough to put on the uniform and go through all the training and become super different from everybody else in the world. The light needs to go back out and show the world who Jesus is. We need to be holy, set apart, but in the world. We need to be holy in the world. We need to do good deeds that the world can see. Good deeds that will represent God well. Over and over and over again, the New Testament will tell us that we were made and we were remade for doing good deeds. And sometimes I think in the church we shy away from this. We give ourselves excuses, and they're you know, religious ones. They're you know, faith-based excuses. No. I know this one. Let me say, salvation is about faith, not works. But we need some clarity on this issue. We need to be clear on this issue. I mean, it's really good if you remember the phrase, we are saved by faith, not by works, right? I mean, we've taught a lot about that in this church. It's very true. We are saved by faith, not by works. But if you're going to remember that one, remember this one as well. We are not saved by good works, but we are saved for good works. Can you remember that one as well, please? It's longer, I'm sorry. But we are not saved by good works, but we are saved for good works. We mentioned Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10 earlier, just a little bit ago. And the full verse says this: "For we are God's masterpiece. He has created us anew in Christ Jesus so that we can do the good things he planned for us long ago." It's not saying that those things saved us. It says we are God's masterpiece. God has done this work in us. We are pointing to God. God has saved us so that we can do the good things that he planned for us to do long ago. And if you want more, go to BibleGateway.com. It's a great website, and you can search through the Bible there. Do a search in the New Testament for good works, and then do another one for good deeds, and then do another one for doing good, and you will find dozens and dozens of scriptures that point to this idea and support this command that the light is called to shine in the darkness with good deeds that the world can see that will cause them to glorify God. I guarantee you, we don't have the time to go through all of that today, but it is there. You are the light of the world. You already belong to Jesus, but now you have a job to do. Shine. If the world can't see any of your good works, you're doing it wrong. Show the world good deeds that will represent God well. So at the beginning of today's message, I asked you to think about how hard it is to actually allow someone else to steer you in a new direction. I asked you that because as I have been reading and meditating on the Sermon on the Mount for the past several days, God began to show me how personal, how direct this teaching really is. That if we go to the Sermon on the Mount, just hoping to learn something new and interesting, we're missing the point. That if we go to gain a new perspective on things, still not there. If we sit at Jesus' feet to learn his words, we're wrong. That's not what we're there for. Jesus spoke these words because he is intensely interested in changing you. Hate to put you on the spot there, but Jesus went first on this one. Jesus spoke these words because he was intensely interested in changing you. I was really just seeing, Jesus, this is what you're emphasizing, I think. But I wanted to do an experiment and say, well, what if I did some analysis on this, got some data on this? What would I find? Would that support that conclusion? Or am I just, I'm blowing this out of proportion? So what I did is I copied the entire Sermon on the Mount, electronically copied it and pasted it into a website that would spit out the results as a word cloud. You heard of word clouds, right? So there's a picture of my word cloud up on the screen there. Word cloud will take all the words from an article or a website or a paper, whatever you supply it, and it'll print them out artistically for you such that the words used the most are the largest and the words used the least are the smallest. And the good word clouds will actually be proportional. So if something was used 100 times as much as another thing, it'll be 100 times bigger, 100 times thicker, or something like that. So this one's a proportional one. So if we've got the words twice as much or twice as big, etc. And so it shows, you can see in this word cloud, wow, Jesus talks about the Father pretty often. He talks about heaven pretty often. You can see some blessings in there because the word blessed shows up there, in rather large text. And you can see some of the major themes of the Sermon on the Mount. Pretty interesting. But I didn't see some of the words I thought I would see. Come to find out, well, most word cloud generators actually automatically remove certain words, all these really, meaningless words as far as content. They're just there to link all the other words together. So they remove a bunch of the words so that your graphic will be more meaningful and be able to talk about subjects and verbs and things like that are actually the emphasis. You don't want, the word is taking up 30% of your graphic. Well, that really helps me, know what the emphasis of this is. So they take out a lot of the common words. But then I found out, you could change that option. Say, no, show me everything. And I wanted to see everything because I didn't want to miss what Jesus was emphasizing the most. And so you know what I found? The most common word used in the entire Sermon on the Mount, and at least the English translation that I was using, NIV translation, the most common word was the word the. Yeah. 115 times the word that was used. You're not sharing my awe on this. Okay, well, but that's fine, though, because there was actually another word, though, that was used equally as common. There was a tie for first place. There was one more word that appears 115 times in the Sermon on the Mount, and that word is you. You come up again and again and again. You is tied for first place. But you know what? If we combine it with the word your, when he's also referring to you, it blows everything out. Blows everything else out of the picture. Jesus is actively and directly speaking to and about his listeners 187 times in the Sermon on the Mount. I did the graphic again, and you can see it on the screen. And when I combined you and your together, it breaks the word cloud. I used to have a pretty circle there with all the words in it, but these personal terms of address show up so often that when they were put in the word cloud, they look like those are the only things that mattered. So I don't want us to miss that. Jesus spoke these words because he was intensely interested in changing you. He starts with these simple statements, but they assign you an identity. And then the rest of the sermon builds from there. You want to know how you should be different? Listen on. Read on. He never loses focus on this. He will challenge you over and over and over again. He will get very personal with you. He will stay very direct with you. And he will end the whole thing this way. He wraps up the whole Sermon on the Mount this way. The last story he tells, the last teaching he tells, is a parable. And it shows the story of two men. One who has great stability and strength, and another who experiences disaster and loss. The difference between the two? Both listened to Jesus. One of them changed who he was.